right, so I started, my background is martial arts. So I've been doing martial arts for about 25 years. And I basically represented England. So I was fighting the England National Karate Team. And I did that. I competed probably, I had about 200 fights. I got injured. This is how I got to check stuff. So I got injured. Basically, I had my jaw dislocated. And I wasn't aware of it for about 6 years. I had a lot of body compensations due to that. And then I had another injury which was not related to the Czech stuff. Not related to martial arts, sorry. And I was in crutches for 1.5 years as well. So that had a lot of structural dysfunctions happen to my body also. And from that, I basically saw an osteopath who said that I had to walk with a step in my shoe for the rest of my life. And that I need to see him again like 6 weeks later. I happened upon Paul Czech. I studied scientific back. I basically did some of the exercises from that for about 6 weeks, and I corrected everything that was wrong with me. Went to saw the osteopath, and he was like, "What the heck did you do?" And I explained, he's like, "Wow, keep doing it." And that's what led me to the path of the Czech stuff. And that's how I kind of got into that. And in my spiritual side, I've been kind of studying esoteric sciences and had studied with a lot of spiritual schools since about 1987. So I've studied a lot of spirituality stuff, Sikkim, Reiki, Reju, all these sort of spiritual practices, and I use that to kind of complement that physical stuff. And then now I can integrate that with the HLC, so it kind of bridges the gap between the spiritual, the nutritional, which is more accepted, and then the physical, which is very accepted. And that's kind of been my journey. I've worked with a lot of elite-level athletes, and my main thing is movement, and I get that from martial arts, the understanding, the mechanics of the movement. And yes, and I integrate that with my emotional self-management and spiritual stuff all together, so I try to use a uniform approach with my clientele.
Brilliant, thank you. So, just the topic on today will be injury prevention.
Mm.
So, for say the tech worker 3 or 4 years deep, and all of a sudden starting to feel a bit of pain, or just maybe being aware of the way they're living life isn't optimal, what would you recommend?
Well, you know, we, as you know, we have this four-stage principle of moving correctly and functioning. So with that, you know, the key thing for most people straight away, whether they're a worker, whether they sit for a long period of time, they're a security guard, the most important thing I think that people need to first of all address is training with the understanding of balancing the front of their body and the back of their body, because you know most the problem with most people is they train for aesthetics rather than function. And when you train for aesthetics, you predominantly work the front of your body for a look, but have the back of their body bare. So you know, like you know, we said off ear about this naked spine. You know, people have a six pack, but they have a naked spine. And you don't ever hear about people, you know, getting abdominal strains, but you do hear about people getting backaches. Or, you know, 85% of all people have predominantly low back pain. So, because of the fact that most people focus on strengthening the front of their body without the balance to the back of their body, you typically hear most people have pain in the back of their body versus the front of their body. So, the first bit of advice I'd give to people like that would be to focus on learn to breathe properly, because the diaphragm, you know, works directly with the stabilizing muscles of the trunk. So that's automatically going to help people to learn how to have a functional abdominal wall, and then learn functional abdominal exercises that are more in a standing environment, because most injuries don't take place laying on the back. They take place standing. So it's really strange when you see people, during time they develop any form of concept of abdominal exercise is from the ground. But you never hear of somebody injuring their back, laying on their back. So it makes no sense. So if we're going to train, we have to train in a way that correlates to the needs and demands of the body, which means mostly in a standing environment. So that's pretty much what I would start off with, is learning how to train functionally, learning how to train the abdominal wall in a standing environment, and learning how to train the body by balancing the front and the back of the body.
Okay. Perfect. Now, a lot of people I work with would be kind of GA athletes, and like you mentioned, the recent coaching can often be a lot bigger, and it's been maybe a job with him. But what level of frequency maybe in off season first would a high performing athlete train?
It's interesting. Off season, okay, going back a little bit, the problem with most elite athletes is, again, this depends on the sport, because if it's tennis, there's no off season, it's constant. So they always have to have a base conditioning phase, as well as a phase that is sport specific, or the, what they call a specificity stage. And in case the people that listen don't understand that, specificity basically means that you prioritize the key movement patterns that are relative to the actions that you're going to be doing in that sport. So that means you may pick only four or five exercises. So let's say, let's use tennis as an example. Let's say, you know, they focus a lot on backhand strokes in their tennis. You don't really want to spend more time, because the more time you spend in the gym training, you take time away from your sport. So you have to isolate three or four key exercises that are going to have the biggest bang or translation to your sport. So for a tennis player, there's no point in them working their chest muscles in a chest press exercise, because they don't really use the chest muscles, because there's no action in tennis where you need to push. So because everything is mainly rotational, you would get an exercise program with four exercises, and you would make those four exercises in the specificity stage. Those four exercises very specific to rotational patterns. Now, going back to your question, pre-season, that's when you start working on all of the support muscles that support the movement patterns they do in their sports. And then you can be clear. So for a tennis player, say they need strength in their legs, you focus on sumo deadlifts, simply because the sumo deadlift crosses multiple patterns of movement. It crosses all the muscles that work the shoulders, the neck, the back muscles, the legs, the hamstrings. So it basically works every muscle in the body. You get them to develop that strength. They don't need the pattern in their sport, but they need the overall strength. If you focus on something like that, you would focus on improving their abdominal function through, like we said, breathing and what we call inner unit activation exercises. So you basically focus on strengthening every single area of their body they may not necessarily need indirectly in their sport. And then in the season, because so much of the time is devoted to actual play time, then you would focus less on a base conditioning program, because base conditioning programs can take 2 hours. You would focus on a 30-minute training session, four exercises, and you may do three sets, and it may be 12 to 15 reps. And that doesn't take away from their play time, because it's only 30 minutes. And that might also include their stretching.
Okay. Brilliant. And to nearly go full circle here, so for the standard tech work, which you're referring to with the closed shoulders and slight forward head posture, which you know, you see a lot these days, what would be the, what you mentioned, bang for buck and movement patterns, what would be the standard, like you say, would be a base level of health before even specialising that, that would be very worthwhile, or which you would recommend for clients, right?
Well, most type of people that you describe, as you said, they have pronated shoulders and the head drops forward. So the first thing is they're going to have altered breathing patterns, simply because they're closing. Because when you think of it like this, if people listening to this can imagine, as your head sits forward, so we've got that kind of caveman kind of idea in our head right now. The head sits forward, and as the head sits forward, it pulls the shoulders forward. As it pulls the shoulders forward, it depresses the sternum. As the sternum closes down, when the rib cage closes down, the abdominal wall starts to shorten and tighten. All that does is, first of all, it restricts breathing. Now, we breathe 25,000 times a day on average. So each one of those breaths is restricted. So the first thing people can do to improve health is to increase their extension patterns. So we would start teaching people how to do things like prone cobras, getting foam rollers, and teaching them how to extend their spine going the opposite way. So people, listen, kind of visualize someone hunched. You would take them in the opposite direction, and then you would build strength in the opposite direction, so they're in a more open position, so that in spite of themselves, they breathe better. And obviously, you know, as we understand the total whole of health, respiration or breathing is key to nutrition, because you get nutrition from oxygen. And that's the one thing you can't survive without. You can survive without chicken and salad, but you can't survive without it. So that would be the very first thing I would do, is improve their posture by reversing their patterns of posture. And therefore, straight away, they're going to have an increase in energy. That's the first thing. And then the second thing, obviously, is water. You know, get people to figure out what they weigh. The easiest way to calculate that is half your body weight in fluid ounces. So in other words, well, half your body weight in kilos in fluid ounces. So if you weigh 100 kilograms, then you basically half that. It's 50 kilograms. And 50 kilograms in fluid ounces is 50 ounces. So it's typically about 33 ounces per 1 liter of water. So if they get a minimum of that, they're at least hydrating themselves. And then hydration relates to breathing as well, because when you breathe, you have water in the lungs as well as salt. So it actually helps improve breathing if your lungs are hydrated.
Excellent. Would we talk about, say, morning routine or what breathing exercises you'd recommend in the morning?
Right. So, when we talk about breathing, there's two different types of breathing. There's what people know as cellular respiration, which is the exchange of hemoglobin and oxygen. So you have one oxygen molecule to four hemoglobin molecules, and that allows you to transfer the oxygenated blood to the cell. So that's known as cellular respiration. And then you have what people call external respiration, which is when you force yourself to inhale and exhale. So first of all, you go through the external respiration, where you voluntarily or involuntarily, you know, when you're just walking down the road and you're breathing, take oxygen into the body, and then the gaseous exchange, which is the cellular version. And then the gaseous exchange is the chemical changes that happen through respiration. So respiration is truly cellular. So that's the first thing. So as we said earlier, 25,000 breaths a day now, that's based on normal humanity that breathes too fast. So the textbooks typically state that the average person breathes about 12 to 18 times per minute. That's not normal, that's common. The true statement should be between 6 and 10 breaths per minute, and that would give you about 16,000 breaths per day. Now, what that would mean is the slower you breathe, the more vital you are, because there's this thing, a term, I think it's called optoptosis. Scientists have found that the faster you breathe, the quicker you die. And they theorize that everyone has a maximum amount of breaths in their lifetime. And let's say the number is 100 million. It's going to be more than that, but let's just say that's the number. And you breathe faster, you will die sooner. If you breathe slower, those same breaths you use less frequently, so you live longer. It's a hypothesis that they're working on, but it makes sense. What we do know is if the faster you breathe, the faster your thoughts move, because when someone's worried or anxious, they breathe faster. You know, that's standard. So we know that your thoughts are linked to your breath, and your breath is linked to your thoughts. So the first benefit, based on that, the first benefit of learning to breathe slowly is changing your emotional state. If you're in a car crash, suddenly your breath is altered to a rapid pace because you're now in a stress state or in a sympathetic survival state. So that's kind of like a summary to preface the benefits to your listeners. So some really good breathing exercises that I find my clients, I give my clients to do is power breathing. It's an exercise that I learned some years ago, and you can stand or you can sit with really good posture so your spine is aligned. And you basically place your hands, palms touching above your head. I know they can't see, but palms touching above your head. Your elbows are typically pointing away from each other. So it's almost like a prayer position, but with your hands above your head. And again, you have to be in really good posture. You can be sitting or standing. And you will do 10 powerful breaths. So I'll mimic it so the listeners can hear. And you do that. So it's in through the nose and out through the mouth. It's 10 powerful breaths. That's singles, and then you do 10 doubles. And the breathe out is like you're blowing up a balloon. So it's a powerful pursed lips. And it takes 1 minute to do the 10 singles and 10 doubles at the most. And what it does is it generates an incredible amount of heat in your body. So it pumps fluids, Because one of the things that is really good about breathing is every breath is a hug to your internal organs. So when you do powerful breathing, it's a massage for the organs, because every organ in the body flexes, extends, side bends, and rotates. And when you breathe, you're actually helping those organs to be pumped. So it pumps all the organs in the body, it flushes out toxins, so it's fantastic for cleansing the body. So if you're looking for a suggestion, I'd suggest that, and they do that, you know, it's pretty much as soon as they wake up. And you want to do like about 3 times a day. So that's maybe a minute and a half, 2.5 minutes of your life, you know, in a day. And I think that's a fantastic exercise. If you want an additional one,
please.
All right, okay, one more. There's an exercise where I'm actually going to credit someone. I actually learned this from Troy Casey, the Certified Health Nut.
Oh, I love Troy.
Yeah, so I saw him post a video on this, which is really good. And so it was called the, I don't really know the name of it, but it's 8-8-8-8. So it basically, you do 4 breaths that are all 8 seconds long. So what you do, you inhale for 8 seconds, hold your breath for 8 seconds, exhale for 8 seconds, and then hold again for 8 seconds. And then you restart the cycle without a gap. Now, that's important because sometimes people, they'll do the inhale, the hold, exhale, and hold. And then they'll take a little bit of a breath and then they'll start again, and that makes it easier. You have to actually make sure you've held your breath for the final stage and then do a slow inhale again. It's really hard because when you think about it, you only inhale at the start, the rest of it you're not inhaling. So you inhale and then you hold it, exhale and hold it. So you've gone, you know, 22 seconds or so without actually doing inhale. So some people find it really hard. So it's really good to strengthen the diaphragm. And as we know, the diaphragm is such an important muscle. So that's a really good exercise. And I suggest that people start with about 3 reps or 3 rotations of that, because it's very challenging. Once you've done the first rep, the second rep gets harder because, you know, you held your breath for quite a long period of time. So if people struggle on that, they can start with 5-5-5-5 instead and build up to the 8, because it's quite hard. And maximum, I'd say, for anyone to try and use 5 cycles of it. And again, you don't have to do it 3 times a day. You can literally just do that once a day. Morning would be really good. If someone's quite stressed and agitated at night time, then do it at night time to help sit the body into this pH alkaline state, which is more of the rest recovery sort of state to prepare for bed.
Excellent. Brilliant. Now, you mentioned one thing there on anxiety.
Mm.
Could you speak a little bit about this maybe, and if there's any additional ones in particular on breath that you recommend for anyone with anxiety or anything that type of thought, would be great.
Alright, so the limbic, which is the emotional system of the body, feeds directly into the labia scapula and the scalenes, which are the muscles of the neck and shoulders. So most people, when they are calm, if they've learned how to breathe properly, they would typically do what we call a diaphragmatic breath, where their stomach pops out. And this is not common nowadays, so I'd have to reference babies. If you know, people listen to this, just look at a baby, and you know, all babies have pot bellies because they learn to breathe diaphragmatically with the stomach coming out and in. And when you breathe like that, you are not using your accessory muscles or the muscles of the state, which are the muscles around the neck and shoulders. So you don't tie directly into these emotional muscles. So when you breathe in this way, you're breathing in a calm state. When somebody is anxious, what happens is the breathing pattern changes from a diaphragmatic or belly breath to a neck breath. So they now start to breathe into their neck and shoulders, which is why most people, when they're tense or anxious, their shoulders hunch up and they get really tight, and then they start complaining about neck and shoulder pain, simply because what's happened is their body's learning through a fear response to shut down the diaphragm and to breathe only into their neck and shoulders. And because of that, the limbic emotional muscles are directly involved directly into the neck. So it forces those neck muscles to become really short and tight. And all that does is, the stronger those muscles get through constant daily anxiety, the more facilitated they become. That means the more happy to work they are. So even if the person may not be anxious the next day, the body still mirrors what it normally does, which means it makes you breathe into your neck and shoulders. So psychologically, you may not be anxious that day, but physiologically, your body reacts the same. So your body doesn't understand the difference. It still thinks you're in a stress response. So thus, your digestion is affected, because when you're in a sympathetic or stress state, your digestion lowers as your anxiety increases. So then that has a top-down effect to digestion. And as we know, in the Western world, 90% or more people are constipated. And just one real quick thing of constipation. People think that if they go to toilet every single day, they're not constipated, and that's incorrect. It's how much you pass every day that determines whether you're constipated. So the last stage of the colon is 12 inches long. If you're not passing 12 inches of feces every single day, you are constipated. And most people in the Western world don't want to count it. They don't want to look at it. They don't want to have anything to do with it, so they don't look at their feces. So because they go every day, you think, oh, okay, you may be passing 6 inches a day. And then you have a backup, because there's waste that's still in there. And when that waste is in there, it starts to rot and ferment. And then when that happens, you get things like bowel cancer. So, and again, if you were learning to breathe properly, that would help pump the organs to help get that stuff out of your body as well. So it has a top-down effect to digestion. So it's global. And sorry, you said an exercise.
If you think the first two are sufficient, or if so there's any specific two of one two.
There's a really good exercise. Again, I would credit Paul Cech. Really good exercise that Paul Cech develops in that, breathing squats. So breathing squats is a really good exercise. So for the people listening, if they were to imagine if they were out in the jungle or in the forest and they wanted to go for a dump, not number one, but number two, and the typical position they would sit in, the wide, deep squat position, that's the breathing squat. So what you want to do is you start by sitting down in that deep, deep, deep position. And you come up, you want to actually exhale as you come up, and then inhale as you come in, because when you inhale in, you create a stretch. So you inhale as you come in, and you stretch the colon, and it allows the colon, which is the last part of digestion, to have this really nice stretch, and you're doing a breath at the same time. So you're tying in movement to breathing, and that stimulates what we call peristalsis, which is a natural contract, relax, wave of the colon, which allows you to pump food through. So that's good for digestion. It's also a very good warm-up stretch. So the people listening, you go to a deep squat. Then as you stand, you bring your arms above your head to the point where your hands almost cross each other. And then you come back down, and then you finish your breath, and you sit into that deep position. So that's really good. And you want to do like between 6 and 10 reps. And you want it to be as slow as you can breathe. So if it takes you 10 seconds to inhale and 10 seconds to exhale, then you want to move up and down for 10 seconds each way. And if you find it too hard to breathe that slowly, then you just move quicker. But you match the breath. If it's 5 seconds up and 5 seconds down, you time the breath to move.
Brilliant. Excellent. So we have a bit more time than I first thought. So could we talk a little bit about breakfast? So it is one that in Ireland, especially, porridge is still the staple. You know, people in the last couple of years have really became aware of health, but there still seems to be that block of just eating a dinner for breakfast. But maybe if you could go into that a little bit more.
So you were saying in Ireland, the staple is to have porridge in the morning.
Porridge for breakfast and a cup of tea.
Right. Okay, so the first thing on that is, they say you are what you eat, but it's another thing, you are when you eat as well. So one of the things I always put across to some of my clients is when they're asleep, let's say they hopefully get their good 8 hours of sleep. They haven't eaten in that 8 hour period. Their body's gone through a lot of detoxification, a lot of rest and repair, because you go through your repair at nighttime. So it takes a lot of energy to actually repair. So you basically starve yourself for 8 hours. And then woken up and you've had porridge, which is not very sustainable. One, it's a carb. Yes, you could say it's a complex carb, but it still doesn't last very long. And most people in the Western world are protein types anyway. So it will probably last in terms of energy for about an hour. And if they're having a cup of tea or coffee, those are both diuretics. So it actually irritates the intestines anyway. So your body actually wants to get it out, get the nutrients out of the body. And typically, any form of tea or coffee are similar to alcohol in that, in terms of hydration, for the body, the more hydrated the body is, the easier it is to digest and eliminate waste from the body. Coffee, tea, and alcohol typically, for every one molecule of water you get in, you lose about 3 or 4 molecules of water because of the diuretic properties of coffee, tea, and alcohol. So they're starting their day by dehydrating their colon, and then they're eating a simple sugar that won't last for more than an hour. So what that does is it puts the body into more of a starvation stage, and then shifting them into a catabolic stress stage because the body is now in starvation. So what it does is start to cannibalize itself. It starts to eat. So if I said fat, someone would go, yay! But it also eats muscle. And we need a specific amount of muscle to be able to burn fuel. So what will happen is, if you continue down that road, you'll have less fat, but you'll also have less muscle. And that means you have less muscle to burn calories. What that now means is you have to eat less to not put on any weight, because if you ate 1,000 calories a day and you burn 1,000 calories a day, you won't put on weight. But now if you ate 1,000 calories a day, you've lost muscle. And now you're only burning 800 calories a day. The same food you ate will now make you put on weight, which is why some people get confused. As, I haven't eaten anything different, but I'm putting on weight. It's because you're doing this tiny little meal in the morning. So when we look at the food groups of people, they starve themselves in the morning when they need the most amount of energy, because it's the longest duration of time when they haven't eaten, because it's been at least 8 hours. Then, when they come home from work, when their body isn't in a repair state and their digestion has lowered because their body is getting ready to shut down, they have their biggest meal. And then they wonder why they put on weight. So if you think of it like this, how many people actually do a number two at 10 o'clock at night? You don't normally do it, you normally do it in the morning. So that means if you had a big meal at 9 p.m. and you're not clear of it, what's it doing? It's sitting in your body, it's rotting. And when it rots, that means your body has to increase fat because you store toxic waste in the fat stores. So it's creating this vicious cycle, and hopefully this is kind of starting, people are starting to see it happen in their own lives with this. So what we should do is have a massive breakfast, like a real meal, balancing proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. And then our meals should progressively get smaller throughout the day as we become less active. You know, otherwise, you're going to have to kill yourself in the gym because you're eating the wrong way. So we're not saying don't eat the same food as you eat. The first thing we'll probably do is swap those foods around. And that's the easiest thing. Just change the timing. Eat your biggest meal at the start. Right? So they have that saying, breakfast like a king, dinner like a pauper. You know, those things come around for a reason. So that's the best thing simplest thing that people can start doing.
Excellent. So just could you give some examples of that one? Because that's one where people seem to struggle a bit. And when I say, I had a steak for breakfast. And I had a steak for breakfast. I could never do that.
Yeah,
guys I've worked with. Now I'm sort of encompassing it. I love having steak for breakfast. Mm. Maybe want to try a bit more. So is there anything maybe you'd suggest that would be easier for people to get into it then? Or?
As an easy way to transition to eating bigger
meals?
Yeah. I think the safest thing, especially people that are used to having these tiny little meals in the morning, I think the easiest thing for them to do is to gravitate to maybe something like have their, again, this isn't ideal, but we're looking at an easy transition. If they're going to have their porridge in the morning, then we'd say something like, okay, then at least add something like a smoothie, because at least you're getting a lot of nutrients. And then Wednesday, because smoothies actually fill your stomach quite a lot, so you're now getting to the idea of actually having to expand your stomach in a quite gentle way. So you may just do that for a couple of weeks as a transition, so that your stomach's getting used to accepting more of an expansion in the morning. Once you do that, and your stomach's slightly expanded, then you can start by bringing some small meats in there. So, like if you have like a big steak is like a real shock to have in the morning, then maybe you want to start with a couple of boiled eggs, so you're gradually transitioning into balancing, because it is very important to have, whether you're a carb type or a mixed type of protein type, it's very important to have proteins at the start of the day because it's a slow release fuel. So if the idea of something is harder than the benefit of something, then you don't get a reward anyway. So you start with an easy transition. So start with a couple of boiled eggs. Have your porridge if you need to, and have a couple of boiled eggs. So at least you start to get some protein. Start to see the benefits of a slower regulated fuel. Once that starts to make sense and your body's reacting, then you don't need willpower, you don't need coaching, because the body is actually reacting and they can actually see it. So, you know, I'd say to people, write down your findings, how you felt. I mean, once you understand that you feel better, you know, transition into that state won't seem so bad simply because your body's actually telling you. You know, we say the body never lies. So the body's actually telling you through how you feel. And you won't need to, because, you know, a lot of those people, on the way to where they probably go and get some chocolates or sweets because they had a blood sugar crash because they've been eating sugar in the morning. And because their blood sugar's dropped, like, right, I'm near work, but I'm going to get a pack of Smarties. Or, you know, I don't know the names of these things, like Mars bars or something. And then once they eat their proteins, you know, the blood sugar levels don't crash because it's a regulated flow of energy. That itself will teach the person, inspire themselves to have more protein to start with it.
Excellent. Now, one thing which triggered, as I said, on the way to work, grabbing a pack of Smarties or a croissant or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a standard now, I presume it's the same in London, but standard is a new coffee shop popping up at every corner.
Yeah.
And we spoke earlier on how the. We spoke earlier on how the coffee is a drink and you need to consume more water.
Yeah.
But maybe we could talk a bit more about coffee, how to healthily consume coffee, and maybe touch on, is it a good or bad thing, or what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's always healthy alternatives. So, all right, let's get the horrible stuff out of the way. So people that go to coffee shops, the coffee that they're drinking, obviously these companies are about making money. So first of all, the coffee you're drinking is substandard. That's always the case. The cows themselves, because of the demand, pretty much because of the demand of coffee, cows themselves are being forced to constantly produce milk. Now, for those who don't know, there's a lot of people that think that cows just keep producing milk all day, every single day, for our consumption, and that's absolutely wrong. Just like a woman produces milk only for her young. A cow only produces milk only for its young. Now, shock, cows aren't pregnant 24/7 year round. So they don't naturally produce milk all the time. So a lot of these companies that are supplying to the coffee makers are having to produce milk all the time to hit the demand of these coffee shops that are popping up, like you said. So my point on this is that when a cow is producing milk all day, every single day, way beyond the time that it carries, what it actually does is the cow's udders start to produce pus because they're constantly producing milk all the time and they're hooked up to these metal machines. And this pus from the udder goes into the milk. It's called mastitis. And that mastitis pus is basically going in that milk, and then what they do is they just blend it up in their pasteurized way. And then they put it in the shops, and you're basically drinking this pust milk. So that's the first thing. So hopefully that straight away is letting people think, you know what, maybe I don't want that coffee anymore. That's the milk side of it. The coffee side of it, obviously the coffee beans are substandard. If you're going to have coffee, the easiest way to transition is to obviously grow your own coffee beans or buy organic coffee beans and have your own coffee maker and have raw milk instead. Because at least that way, you're actually going to get a far better kick without the negative side effects of, you know, substandard coffee. So there's a lot of toxins, a lot of, like I said, mastitis that is in this cheap coffee. So if you actually have a coffee machine you can purchase, they're not that expensive. You can get really good coffee machines for like £100 or euros in Ireland, maybe 150 euros or so. And really start investing in organic coffee. It, from what I'm told, I'm not a coffee drinker, but from what I'm told, it tastes hell of a lot better because it has so much more flavor to it. And when you start drinking raw milk is an entire food by itself. So you're actually getting sustained by that, and you also don't get the irritants that naturally come with these cheap coffees. So that way, you can actually drink your coffee without the negative side effects of having flatulence or, you know, IBS or, you know, it needing to go to the toilet simply because you like the taste but you don't like the after effect.
And many years ago I was working in an office where we actually had our own coffee machine with the pasteurized almond milk you mentioned. And there's times when, you know, I go in the morning, first thing it was free coffee, but I would have a coffee then just before now I have another coffee, lunchtime coffee. 3 o'clock, another coffee. Come home, I nearly automatically come on to not get up for your tea or coffee. And what would you say, what would be the ramifications of this? Or is this as big a problem maybe that, for me at the time, was as such that wasn't nearly, I think girlfriend at the time said to me, she was like, what are you doing? I was coffee, it wasn't until she said it to me, that then I was like, well, maybe I should rethink this a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things I sometimes say to some of my clients is, you know, coffee isn't a fatigue deficiency. And that's what some people think, oh, I'm tired. That means I'm lacking coffee. No, that means you're lacking energy. You're just now replicating. You're basically allowing yourself to participate in a bad lifestyle and covering it up by drinking coffee. Your body is telling you need something. So, you know, a really good transition for people that need coffee 12 times a day. Even. I actually had a client who was a fitness model, and she was drinking 15 cups of coffee a day. And, you know, I got her down to 4 cups of coffee probably in a couple of weeks. The transition was going to power teas, and this is something that, you know, your listeners can do. A power tea, how you can make this is you get gelatin flakes, you know, the Great Lakes gelatin flakes. So you guys can just, you know, listeners can just go and search Great Lakes gelatin flakes online. You get that, you get coconut oil, you get 2 tea bags of only Yogi or Pukka tea, because the flowers they use are a lot purer. And the other companies that do herbal tea, there's a lot of added sugars in them, so there's no benefit anyway. So Yogi tea or Pukka tea. So you have 2 tea bags of that, and you mix that with water, and you drink that. It'll give you the same kick of coffee in a very, very natural way, because it's self-sustaining. And when I got that woman on the power tea, so it's called power tea. When I got the woman on the power tea, you know, within 2 weeks she dropped to only 4 cups of coffee. And you know, people know, figure athletes, they train a hell of a lot. So I even look at 6 hours a day. So she could get away with dropping, you know, almost 2/3 in a very short period of time, with the demands that she places on her body, that people that just work desperate shouldn't have a problem doing that. So that's a really good transition.
Excellent. I'm just drawing all the information out, which is brilliant. Something I want to touch on a little bit now, and I know we're getting on the further end of time, is the state of happiness. And a lot of people that I try to ask, are you happy now? I'm like, no. And then I said, well, when are you happy last? And don't even seem to know. Like, don't even really consider what happiness is for them. Would it be a road or a map that you would suggest to someone in that regard?
Yeah, there's a saying that, again, I love all these sayings. Really powerful saying that kind of summarizes this. Success is getting what you want. Happiness is wanting what you get. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, there's a saying that all addictions are simply examples of unmet needs. So people are addicted to habits, and most people are focused on the addiction. You can't correct the addiction. You can only correct what the addiction is covering up. And the addiction is typically covering up something where you're not happy in your life. And the reason why most people aren't happy in life is typically when you see that statement that 95% of all people that go to college don't even use their degree that they've got, because they're not happy with what they were studying in the first place, and they go and do something completely different. So it basically means they have no direction. And there's another saying, if you have no direction in life, any path will take you there. So people walk around aimlessly, not knowing what makes them happy. And because they haven't established core values, they don't know what the pinpoint or direction in life should be. So nothing they do will make them happy, because they haven't even established what happiness is to them, because they haven't established their core values. So for the listeners, what's core value? Core values are basically your guiding principles, the things that you adhere to that are what make you happy. And you have to identify that by figuring out what your dream is. So, you know, if every child had a dream, you know, like Martin Luther King, I have a dream. You know, he lived his dream. So, you know, everyone, when they're a child, like they want to be an astronaut or whatever it is, but they latch onto a specific dream, something that they're passionate about. So the way that we identify our dream is by establishing our core values. So what I'll ask people to do is, first of all, find out what your core values are in typically about three different areas. One, what are your core values when it comes to all of your relationships? So relationships with friends, family, and your loved one, your partner. What I mean by that is, you know, have you identified what type of partner you're interested in? You know, whether they're short, tall, whether they're into the same things you're into. So do you want someone that is into meditation, that does yoga, goes to cinema with you? You know, identify your core values of what your standard is for that. Your core values for your family. Maybe you only want to see your family once a week because when you're around them more than that, you get into arguments. So you establish a parameter for, okay, my core value when I relate to my family is I'm only there for 2 hours each time, and we don't talk about religion, as an example. That might be a core value. You establish core values in relationships. Then you establish core values in your career. So you say, I don't want to work more than an hour away from work. I'm sorry, from home. I don't want to work at 6 a.m. I don't want to work past 8 p.m. Establish what your core values are, things that represent you at work. Then you look at your personal lifestyle. You know, what are your core values? I need 5 hours every week to train, and you know, or I want to train 30 minutes every single day as one of my core values. One of my core values is I must drink clean mineral water 2 liters every single day. I must spend 20 minutes doing Tai Chi. You know, establish what your lifestyle core values are. I must go to bed by 10:30. So once you establish all of these parameters, then those, your core values simply support your dream. Because if one of your core values was, let's say as an example, one of your core values was you wouldn't eat, you wouldn't be around people that, let's say alcohol. You know, your core value may be you don't like alcohol. Well, you wouldn't apply for a job where you work at a bar. So that would be a core value that would start to kind of decipher what type of career path you do, because whatever career path you do has to support your core values. It has to be right in line with your core values. So once they build their core values, then that supports their dream. And once they start working towards their dream, because they've got their core values and their dream has to be in line with it, then they can be happy. It's the roadmap. But typically people aren't happy because they don't have core values and they don't know what makes them happy anyway. So it's about getting quiet and listening, taking the time and being quiet and just listening to what is your passion. And if you're not sure, just think, you know, have a look at 50 jobs written on the table and just think about one of the jobs and see yourself in that job. And then identify, how do I feel right now? Live it, actually live that job and see yourself. Like if you, let's say you want to be a waiter, see yourself being a waiter. And what does it do for you? Does it move you? Do you feel energized? And if you don't, move on and keep doing that until you find, oh my gosh, I feel so warm inside thinking about being a barrister. Then you establish a dream that makes you a core value support.
Excellent. Really great answer. I'm actually going to ask one final one because...
can you pause?
Sure. Now, seriously, about this last question. So, a lot of friends that I have, particularly ones I've worked with in regards to health, are actually nurses. And my family has been very caregivers, really want to help people. That's what I've got into nursing. And in Ireland, I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but they work 12 to 13 hour shifts, normally 4 to 5 weeks, 3 or 4 days a week, and then they do a week and nights. So, and this is kind of a parallel contract. Is there any tips that you give for people to rebalance themselves during their nights? Or what would be the strong points to kind of nearly survive during this? So, for example, a very close friend of mine will find himself losing loads of body weight in this week. He hasn't managed to train at all. Really struggles to sleep, might only get 2 or 3 hours sleep a day. So it's afterwards, you know, they do get a good time off afterwards to kind of recover. That's really where it comes in. But is there anything then, either during the night, beforehand, or afterwards, that you think would be really important for nurses?
Really good question. People that This, the interesting thing about that is if the person can actually pick to only work nights, typically most people don't want to work nights. So sometimes people are tied into rotating shifts where they work middle of the day, they work mornings, and then they work evenings. It's actually better if they only work nights, because most of the other staff won't want to work nights anyway. They're like, oh my gosh, yeah, you take matches, aren't you? But it's actually better that you have a set shift, because even though our body goes into a repair stage at nighttime, it's a set rhythm your body gets used to. So if you kept on changing rhythms, your body cannot clear for it. It would be like going to China, spending 2 days there, then going to Australia, then going to Russia, then going to America, and keep going. Your body would never, ever get used to it. So all you could do is preserve yourself as best as possible. So, but you know, time zones, your bodies can't adapt. So if the first tip is, if they can just choose the night shift, that would be better. And if they can't do that, they're fixed into this pattern of rotating shifts and 10 days on, 4 days off. The best things they can do to help their body is grounding. For those, you know, who don't know what grounding is, you can just go on Google earthing itself. There's a lot of real benefits to it. So you can either go and get an earthing sheet or an earthing mat. The earthing sheet is something that you put on your bed, and it helps the body to heal after the stress of an incredibly daunting day. Because obviously, as you know, people are working late hour shifts, they're just going to be adrenaline fatigued. So an earthing sheet or an earthing mat helps the body to really focus its healing in a very short period of time. So, you know, you basically put that in your bed and sleep. So if you're only getting 3 hours a day, get some really focused, energized 3 hours. The next thing, if people can't afford them, because they're about, in euros, probably about 180 euros. If people can't afford that, then go outside and put your feet on grass, barefoot on grass, because the planet Earth mother, for a reason, it actually helps to dump positive ions into the ground and re-energizes you with negative ions. People always think negative is bad, but no, negative ions are really good for your body. So that helps the healing process. If they can get their feet on grass for 20 minutes a day, that helps the healing process. So you're just trying to find ways to actually deal with the stress, other than don't do that job. You know, if that's not the option, then that's the thing. The next thing they can do is start looking at getting things like licorice root, which is really good to support the adrenal glands. Licorice fruit, try not to get, don't go into the shop and buy licorice as a sweet, because it's mainly sugar. So if you're going to get the sweet, the licorice in the licorice form, you want to get salt licorice, which is the real proper licorice, which doesn't have the extra sugar in it. Outside of that, you could then also try to source things like Intramax. Intramax is a supplement that it's like a multi vitamin. It's incredible. That helps to support your energy levels. But if you can't find that, you can get that on Amazon. Other than that, you can get things like Adrenal Boost. Adrenal Boost is like a tincture, and it costs about, in euros, probably about 9 euros. And it'll last about 3 or 4 weeks, and you can just keep buying that, and that supports the adrenal glands. So again, you're just trying to find ways to support the crazy lifestyle of this condition, and that those are some of the best things you can do. In your rest days, the next good thing to do would be go and learn Tai Chi, go and learn Qigong, because what you're trying to do is teach. Like, you know, I always say to people, there's only two things you can do with stress. You can either avoid it or improve your tolerance to it. And that's what we're finding. We're just talking about is how you improve your tolerance to that stress.
Excellent. Great answer. And that's really additional to what I believe in talks. Thank you so much for your time. Maybe give a reference to a website that people can find more your...
My website?
Yes.
Yeah, so 3 W's, warrenwilliamscoaching.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much.